Hey, Dessert and listeners. In today's episode, I am interviewing Nick Thompson from season 2 of the reality TV show called Love is Blind. My first experience with Nick was watching the show and reacting to it on YouTube. I enjoyed his story with his fiance and then eventual wife, Danielle, on the show Love is Blind. I talked a lot about what I saw and I was cheering them on and hoping that they would do well. And then they got married at the altar. Then a year later, I heard through news stories that they had gone through a divorce about a year after getting married-ish. I don't know the exact timeline. And then last month, in April of 2023, I started receiving a lot of emails from y'all saying that Nick Thompson was in the news, and also he was using his social media account to talk about the way in which cast members are mistreated during the filming of the show, and that he was starting a foundation or an organization to advocate for better labor practices, essentially. And then a little bit later, I received an email from someone that was representing Nick Thompson saying that he wanted to come on this YouTube channel. And so I interviewed him. So let's get to that interview now. Welcome to the YouTube channel, Nick. Nice to meet you.
It's nice to meet you too. Thanks for inviting me on.
What happened while filming Love is Blind that you would like people to know about?
Well, I think a lot of what's happened on Love is Blind is not exclusive to Love is Blind, which is really shined a light because a few weeks ago, myself and a few of the other castmates from seasons 1 and 2 of Love is Blind came out as whistleblowers to talk about some of the inhumane conditions, along with the mistreatment of human beings. Just to set the stage, you are away for 3 weeks and you spend about 2 of them in the pods. And then you spend about 1 of, I think it was 5 days in Mexico, at least in our season. And then there's some days in between that you just are isolated in your hotel, whether that be back in the pods in LA, or if you were in Mexico, we were isolated for a few days before getting to see our partner. So during that time, I actually lost 15 pounds, which I didn't even notice was happening, but that was because there was such little access to food and water. And then they didn't take really any steps into anyone's dietary restrictions or preferences or anything. You had to ask for water, even in your hotel room. When you're in your hotel room, you ask for water, unless you want to drink out of the bathroom sink. They take your wallet, they take your phone, they take your license, they take your credit cards, they take your cash. If you have it, if you have anything, they take it. So you don't have the opportunity to order your own food from DoorDash or to, you know, pick something up in between. You are just at their beholden. So I noticed in Mexico, when Danielle and I, my ex, took a photo together, I was like, oh my God, my face looks so skinny. And that's when I thought to weigh myself when I got home, because I just could tell from that one photo that we had taken that I had experienced some pretty significant weight loss. So the filming conditions were tough. We were filming 18 to 20 hours a day. You had daytime dating, which was, you know, most of the day. And then there was optional, you know, and I use air quotes, optional nighttime dating, but it was pretty much insinuated if you didn't do the nighttime dating, you were going to fall behind and in a relationship that you have with someone because someone else will step in and do it. So it wasn't a real choice. Once you get to the studio, which, you know, it is a studio, the living quarters is a set. You're in there, you get mic'd relatively quickly and the cameras start rolling. So you're filmed for the next 10 to 12 hours until the union that they have for all of the crew members, they actually guarantee, you know, they don't work more than 12 hours, 10 to 12 hours. So they take a break and they swap out and bring in a whole new crew for the nighttime dating. And that's really the only break that you get during filming. You're still mic'd the entire time. So they're still capturing your sound, but they're transitioning the camera folks and the other production staff. When you are working 18 to 20 hours a day on set, being recorded, being told what you can and can't do, being fed on someone else's schedule, you are basically then allowed 4 or 5 hours to go back to the hotel and sleep at night before you get up and do it all again. So there's a lack of sleep, lack of food, lack of water, and basic like human needs that you need. So what I found too is everything in the pods for me was pretty straightforward. But getting to Mexico, you know, it's well documented that Danielle had a panic attack in Mexico. There was no mental health services. In fact, they decided that they were going to film us anyway after she told them she wasn't feeling right and she had a panic attack. And then to make matters worse, they bring me back and they don't tell me she had a panic attack. They don't tell me anything other than Danielle's not mic'd. Go in there, stay close to her so we can pick up her sound and tell her what happened at the couples party. Once I got in there and I realized what was going on and that there was more going on to than what had met the eye, I immediately took off our microphone or my microphone, I guess, and threw it at the producers and said, we're done. We're going home. They did all hands on deck, came over to convince us. Ultimately, they did convince us to stay. But at that moment, it was very clear that there was not going to be any mental health support whatsoever. And in fact, they were going to exploit any challenges that people have in order to try and drum up drama. The other thing with that, too, is the editing that they did on that scene. It's so confusing because it's not what happened, but like then you see it and you like you almost like get gaslit by it. And the reality that I've come up with out of that specific experience is that editing in reality TV is lying. It's just lying. They don't owe you anything about the truth or what happened. And that is incredibly damaging, not just to the people involved, but it's really damaging to all the people that view it and get this misconception about a person.
Yeah. Lots to follow up with questions there. Let's start with the beginning of what you were saying in terms of taking away your wallet. You have to ask for water. Did they have a justification?
So when you get there, they obviously want to take your phone and they obviously want to take your, you know, basically your ability to buy anything. So maybe, you know, you can't somehow buy a phone. I don't know. Maybe that's a justification. To me, I feel like it's a control mechanism. They strip you of everything and make you completely reliant on them. And that's an abusive tactic, which I'm sure I don't think anyone could disagree or come up with a good case against that. So I believe that it's a tactic to sort of like in a cult, strip you of your identity and force you to be heavily reliant on them. And then that gives them all the power and all the control. So it just creates a whole power dynamic.
Right. For people that might not study this, as I'm guessing you have now, Nick, because you've been through it, and that I have, because I've treated people who have extracted themselves or been liberated from these high control kind of relationships. And it's not just necessarily cults. It could be an abusive marriage. Mm-hmm. It could be a religion. It could be all sorts of things, but high control. It could be the military, for example.
I've actually talked to past cast members who have military experience, and they said this is a military like tactic, what they do to you.
Right. The phenomenon is that if you are trying to break someone down psychologically, if you're trying to gain control over them, if you're trying to get the individual to stop thinking for themselves, stop even believing they have the right to think or to act for themselves, there are ways in which you can strip that from them without even having to tell them you don't have control over your life. You just subtly take control over different aspects of life that at first to the individual might seem like not a big deal. It's like, oh, okay, I'll hand them my phone. That makes sense. Oh, and maybe a little later, they're like, yeah, so we need your wallet because they have some statement or some, you know, we're going to protect that. We want to hold that for you.
That's literally what they say.
Yeah, okay. So it would be seen as an altruistic act. And once that's away from you, then even though technically, let's say you could have asked for it back legally and demanded it and they would have given it back to you, over time, like in an abusive relationship, you just stop.
But who knows that? I didn't know that. I didn't know that I could demand that back because you sign these 30-page contracts. You don't really know. And I went through it and I had someone review it with me and I had to make some changes in it. But you don't. Okay, I'm going to give up my phone. I get that. They don't want you trying to figure out who's what. And then, oh, okay. Yeah. You get there and they're like, give me your wallet and then let me go through your bag. And, you know, it slowly built.
Right. And isolate you from others, which on paper makes sense because they don't want you to leak things or they want you to focus on the Love is Blind, quote unquote, experiment. But as in an abusive relationship, there's always this lingering worry that you're going to be harmed, that you're going to be consequenced physically or emotionally. And with the show, the mechanism that I want to know from you is, was it the $50,000 hanging over your head that was the hammer of, well,
you know, I want to maybe ask for this, but what if by doing this, it leads down this road that eventually I get fined $50,000? Was that a worry?
It was. And they do a really good job of sticking lawyers on you to scare you. And they do it at probably some of your most vulnerable times, right? So they're very, very kind of laissez-faire about the contract at the beginning, and they don't really walk you through it. They just send it over. And then as you get there, it kind of just lingers over you. And to be honest, it took me a while to just process all of this and realize how bad it was. You know, I went from okay, this is awful. This has been a horrible experience, but I found my person. So like, I'm going to focus on that. And then as things deteriorated there, it was just very, you know, very difficult to try and like toe the line of what I'm legally allowed to do and not allowed to do and legally allowed to say and not allowed to say. But the reality is once you leave and the show comes out, they stick lawyers on you and they say, you can do this, you can't do this, you cannot go against the narrative that we tell in the show. And, you know, when editing is lying, you are literally forced to be silenced by something that isn't true. And when I think about it, and the fee, by the way, for that is $1 million each time you do it, or each lie you tell, it's like up to $1 million, and they can do that. Yeah, five times, I think. I'll double check that. But yeah, I mean, it's just there's constantly like this threat of a lawsuit for not, you know, staying within the guidelines of your contract.
Are you worried about that now that you're talking about everything?
So I'm not worried about it. I would wear it as a badge of honor. And I would also, you know, I'm not giving anything that isn't true. And I think when you stand behind the truth, it all kind of works itself out.
But I mean, I'm not a lawyer, and I'm sure you've thought about this. In the contract, it doesn't necessarily delineate between truth or fiction, right? It just says you may not talk about what happened behind the scenes. You may not, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, you may not contradict what is being shown on the television show.
Right. Well, I don't believe I'm contradicting anything that hasn't been either said by somebody else or, you know, happened on the show. Like, to me, I look at it and I separated that early on. And I was like, whatever the heck happens there is not real. Like, my relationship is real. And that's what matters.
Yeah. Who knows? But I can't imagine the show acting on those threats, because the bad press they would get and the future potential cast members would say to themselves, I don't want to go on a show that's going to sue me for $1 million. Right.
And I don't have $1 million. Like, I don't know. I mean, I'm unemployed at the moment. I lost my job at the end of the year last year. I'm like 3 months away from not being able to pay my mortgage if I don't get that figured out. It's like, what are they going to sue me for?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I've heard you in other interviews talk about how they entice you with the prospect of having a lot of money and fame after the show that you can turn into money, that you will end up making all this money from being an influencer or promoting your business or something. And for you, there was a different reality. What happened?
There isn't an endless Brinks truck with a Netflix logo on it that backs up to a reality TV person's house and just drops off money every day. They are making millions and millions, if not billions of dollars off of these shows, and they don't pay you adequately. You make up roughly $7.14 an hour when you take into consideration filming, you know, in the pods, 18 to 20 hours. They don't, unless they can continue to profit off of you, you are not getting the promotional payments and opportunities to go promote other shows. And you want to look at my experience, like we are not the success story that they want. So there is no opportunity there. Like, they don't want to ever talk to us because that would shine a light on some of the stuff we're shining a light on now and the lack of support they give their couples. So to me, I didn't financially benefit. My dog and his Instagram has benefited more financially from this than I have. It isn't just this endless stream of money. It's not an open ATM machine. You can go make a lot of money if you get the right agent and you get the right personality type where you can, you know, put money first. But if you have any kind of, you know, resistance to that, there isn't just free money coming around.
Yeah. So I've heard you talk in other interviews very well about how you would like the industry of reality TV change. So how would you like the industry to change?
So I think there's a lot that needs to change in the industry. And the more that I think about this and the more that I speak about this and You know, I co-founded the UCAN Foundation, which is the Unscripted Cast Advocacy Network. We do five things. We help, we ensure that any past, current, or future reality TV cast member has access to mental health services and access to legal services for contract review, any legal disputes, and make sure that people know what they're actually getting into, and then make sure that they have the resources to help them survive afterwards. So the reason that that foundation exists is because I look at this and I think about what happened in Mexico. And I think about the, and so I've watched post-mortem of my marriage. I watched some of your videos in retrospect, and I appreciate them, by the way. I think you're coming from a very authentic place where that's not the case with a lot of commentators. So thank you for that. But you know, I look back and I'm like, all we did was build toxic communication habits. All we did was build toxic habits with ourselves, you know, from some of the lack of water and stuff like that, but also just pushing yourself to, you know, work all day and then film at night when you get back. It was just exhausting. So you're just in this heightened sense of anxiety. The anxiety just caused us to build these horrific, toxic communication patterns that, you know, we carried on. So mental health support is so important, but it's not just giving someone access to a counselor. It's having them actually on the set in these shows so that they can step in and help people when they are in crisis, whether they are in crisis as an individual or they are in crisis as a couple or in crisis as a group, or they just need somebody to talk to and clear their thoughts out, and or they need someone to help them learn how to navigate, you know, their partner having a panic attack, something, anything like that. And the fact that they say they have it with Love is Blind, they say that they do comprehensive psych evaluations, they say this is a psychological love experiment, they say we will provide you psychological or therapy services before, during, and after. So all I want to see is them follow through on some of this. And I also want to start to see reality TV cast members looked at as more than just influencers. People that are out there saying, you guys aren't workers. What's a worker then? You know, so I want to see basic worker rights provided to reality cast members too, from pay, breaks, contracts, all of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Quick question before we get into the things that you would like to see and things that I would like to see as well. Do you think you'd still be together with Danielle? And I'll cut this out if you don't want me to.
No, it's okay.
Include this. Do you think you would, and I know this is, I'm guessing, you know, a very painful subject for you and Danielle, because I know that you did love each other and I'm sure you still have at least positive feelings, hopefully. Do you think you'd still be together if the show hadn't pushed the two of you to the edge of your mental wellness?
You know, that's a hard question to answer. But what I do think is that we would have had a better chance. I still love her. I care deeply about her. We will always be connected. You know, I still miss her too a lot of the time. So it's, you know, it's hard. And I was removing myself from all of this because it was so damaging. Like, I was not well. I haven't felt the same since. I have had more bad days than I've ever had combined in my life, probably the last year. But, you know, if at that time we had some support and we had, and also once we left, we could not find a couples therapist. It took us months to find one. I was begging the show for help. I was like, help us just find someone. I'm not even asking you to pay for it, even though they say they will pay for it. I believe up to $5,000 after the show. Couldn't get any of that. Couldn't get anyone to help us find someone that could take us. So we not only went through that 7 weeks without support while filming outside of our own individual that we had, but at the same time, we went, I think it was 4 months after filming before we were able to actually find someone. And then we went through a couple counselors before finding one that was, you know, working for us. So it took us a long time to just figure that out. And we had already built so many toxic habits. So whether or not we would still be together, I don't know, but I know that we would have had a much better chance.
That makes a lot of sense. That for me, working with couples over 25 years, when couples come in with nine toes out of the door and hadn't come in earlier or were prevented from coming in earlier, it's much harder to dissolve the resentments, to forego the contempt to build the love back, to have any love there at all. So those crucial months might have been a factor. What I saw in your relationship was absolutely, and I might have said this in my videos, solvable in therapy. With it wasn't necessarily, it depends on people's actions and their dedication and their choices. But the kinds of things that I saw the two of you engaging in conflict wise was, I've seen it a lot of times, let's just say that. It's a very common problem in relationships, in marriages. Yeah, it was hard. It's always hard for me to watch people that I think are suffering from something that a competent therapist would be able to help them with. Also, the other thing is I'll just apologize on behalf of my industry that it would take you 4 months to find someone. Some people, it takes them 4 years to find a good couples therapist that is not only available, but affordable, a good fit, and not a quack, someone that actually knows what they're doing. It's really rough. And it would be so easy for Netflix and Kinetic to put out a call of like, who wants to be, because therapists are interested in their careers and their fame as well. And so imagine, you know, when they just filmed in Seattle, if they just said, hey, Seattle area, couple therapists, who wants to be on our list? You could be a therapist for these couples. If they're promising that and they say they'll allocate $5,000, like, put your money where your mouth is. And of course, the billions of dollars that they're rolling in, $5,000 on the occasional couple that takes them up on this, would be completely unnoticed, but would be very helpful to, you know, to the cast members.
So first, I want to say with the UCAN Foundation, we are 2 weeks and 2 days. So we are 16 days old. We have over 200 mental health professionals that have reached out to be part of our network. We are currently freezing anymore because we have to interview and onboard all of these people. But you know, the response has been overwhelming from the mental health community. I also would like to say that the thing that was really hard that I realized throughout all of this was, I thought because we were married, we were a success story, I thought there would be a level of caring that what wasn't there. And I should have known better because I know how corporations work. But I thought there would be a sense of, you know, you're part of this family now, like you're part of the success. We'll make sure you have every arrow in your quiver to be successful as a couple. You know, we didn't get that. And that was really hard to sort of come to grips with, because they didn't care if we showed up to the reunion and had split, as long as we didn't tell anyone publicly before then. They would have probably loved that drama. So there's just not even with your success stories, like there's no care whatsoever. And look at season two is like probably the worst season. I haven't watched any of them since, but you know, from what I see online and what people say, that is, I mean, it's just, it was a shit show. Pardon my language. You can cut that if you need to.
Yeah. Meaning what? That none of the couples lasted?
Yeah, none of the couples lasted. And again, I haven't watched the new seasons, but like people say it was like extra messy and just shows that the experiment isn't to be taken seriously. And that's only season two. Like we had clout chasers that had figured out there was going to be a lot of clout in this, but it wasn't everyone at that point. And I can only imagine it's going to get, you know, more and more dramatic and more crazy. This last season sounds like it was nuts.
Yeah. It's interesting though. I'm getting season two and three mixed up. So remind me in the audience, there was you and Danielle, there was Jarrett and Ayana. And who else was in that season?
There was Natalie and Shane, who went to the altar but did not get married. There was Deep D and Shake, who went to the altar and did not get married. There was
Sal and Mal.
Oh, Sal and Mal. Yeah, Sal and Mal. I was like, wait a minute, who is the other couple? And then there was also Kyle and Shayna, who didn't make it to the altar. Well, and two, you know, we filmed in April 2021. The show came out in February 2022. You don't know when it's coming out. They don't tell you a couple weeks before. And, you know, so you're sitting there in this pressure cooker of, we have to make sure we are solid before the whole world starts paying attention and commenting on our relationship and picking up on little nuances and all of that stuff. And it's not enough time. Like, it's just not enough time.
Not enough time to let your relationship just be before the onslaught of the internet. And
exactly. And then, you know, when when you need each other the most during the times that those shows are airing, you can't be seen in public together because they don't want anyone to know if you're still together or if you said yes or whatever. So that goes from the day they announced the cast, which I believe was about 2 weeks before the first episode, all the way through the weekend of the reunion, you can't be seen in public together. You take different flights out to the reunion. You take different cars out to the reunion. You're in different terminals at the reunion. Like all of this stuff, which I understand that, but that's at a moment when you need to be relying and leaning on one another more than anybody else. And you're really in a situation where you can't do that.
Yeah, not to bring it back to cults, but I've studied cults, and one of the common aspects and tactics used is isolation, whether it's, you know, the classic with a classic cult in a compound is to isolate them from society and from their family members and their support. But there are other kinds of isolation tactics, isolating your mind, isolating your freedom. And when you don't have the ability to talk with other people, I'm guessing people around you obviously knew that you were married, but you would have to tell everyone, don't tell others, don't post on social media. You might not.
I didn't even tell my work. Yeah, I told them, oh, this is my girlfriend. I got back from my three-week retreat, and here's my. That was it. It's very awkward. You know, and then you got to remember, like, take your ring off when you're with work people. Like, and sure, I probably could have told them the world's a lot bigger than we think it is. But, you know, it's that fear, like you don't know. And then the other thing, too, is when you're back in the pods and in Mexico, so you propose, then you have your reveal, and then you don't see or talk to them after that 25 minutes for 3 or 4 days. So you're in your hotel room by yourself. You're not allowed out. You don't get a key. So if you leave, you're locked out, then you got to go get in trouble by the producers when you ask to get back in. You know, you can't really get caught talking in the hallway to any other castmates. So you're just isolated. And I just remember sitting there, like, after the reveal, and the 3 or 4 days before we got to see each other, I went from, I am the happiest person in the world, this is great, to, I think she's going to break up with me once we get to Mexico. And I know she has mentioned she's gone through similar things. So, like, just that psychological torture of not being able to be with your fiance for days just because they want to be able to capture, you know, as much as they can. It's very damaging.
Why did they do that, though? Why would they isolate you for 3 days?
There's a couple reasons that I would think. One is they want to keep you in that heightened state of anxiety. There's also, I'm sure, some logistics of, so we were supposed to go to Costa Rica, and then that became my, instead of Mexico. So Mexico is like a last minute switch, due to COVID stuff. And so maybe that made the days a little longer, but I definitely think there's that make you feel isolated, make you question everything so that you get there and there's drama. Another thing was, once we got to Mexico, we found out that everyone has a producer, and that those producers cover, typically it seemed like it was 3 men and 3 women. So we each had different producers. And when we got there, we assumed they would work together with us or one of them, but they actually brought someone else in from another show to produce us. You know, there's a lot of things I could speculate about why that happened, but I think what was incredibly damaging for that is it added to our anxiety of, like, wait, why do they need someone else? Is someone, you know, breaking up with someone? I know we both thought that. What it really did was just kind of throw us off. And this guy did not know our story. He didn't see any of the footage in the pods. He didn't know what we bonded on. He didn't know, you know, any of the conflicts that we talked through. And I can honestly say, like, we had such better conflict resolution tactics in the pods than we did in real life. And, you know, it just makes you wonder, who'd they bring here, and why do we get, you know, produced the way we got produced?
So that illuminates what I had come up with myself in relation to what you were talking about earlier in terms of labor rights and humane treatment of human beings. Was an advocate. So your one person that's in your corner, at least that it feels like they're in your corner, I'm guessing, is the producer that bonds with you. And if I can walk myself through what I imagine that you were going through, you fall in love in the pods. There's all this action happening, a lot of emotional ups and downs. You propose, she says yes. You meet her in the hallway. And then, correct me if I'm wrong, but then 3 days you're whisked away.
It was 3 or 4 days. Yeah.
Okay. So you don't, from the time you see her in the hallway and you go to the couch and you sit down and you're looking at each other, you're separated for 3 or 4 days. And then the next time you see her is in Mexico, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
And now, of course, the answer to total isolation would be you just put all the guys together and all the women together, and then at least you're not completely isolated.
So when you're in the pods, they do. So I was next to Kyle and across from Sal in the hotel, and then they had us broken up like in little chunks like that throughout it. But they don't want you, like when we landed, they took us all in vans and said, you can't talk to each other, because they want all of the interactions to be on camera. They want you guys to be meeting for the first time. So even when we were in Mexico, like it was a little bit better, but five of us got breakfast the one day. But like we were still kind of, you know, be in your room. If you want to go to the pool, it's like one person at a time. We did all go to the gym at one point because we were kind of like, screw it. But it was all just monitored and controlled.
Yeah. And again, there's that lingering worry of consequencing you by $50,000 or editing you badly or not letting you have privileges that you might want, like water in the future or something like that.
It's a privilege.
Yeah. And the breaking down of just your own sense of agency. So I imagine that at least you could talk to the producer, and it sounds like you had a good-ish relationship with the producer in the pods, someone that seemed to be in your corner. And you could argue, who knows, you know, and you're careful not to say that you know, because we can't, but it's possible that the production understands that during the pods, they actually want people to get together, right? Because they don't have a show if people don't propose. So it would be, it's in their financial interest for the producers to be pro Nick and Danielle and trying to help the two of you, trying to bridge the gap, trying to put the two of you at ease, trying to help you with your relationship. After that, though, you could argue financially they're incentivized to go in the opposite direction. So you could argue, well, we can't just have the producers suddenly be two-faced. We got to bring in a different producer. You know, it could have been a logistical thing. It could have been, you know, maybe the person just suddenly quit the job, moved into another area. Who knows?
Well, and I'll say too, both of our producers when we were in the pods had said that they made the decision together to just let us be after like our second day, because we clicked so quickly. Like that first day, you know, I've posted before too. Like I went and wrote in my journal when we got back to the hotel room. And it was just like, there's something about her. I don't know. 7 minutes we talked and there's something about her. And it was so different than anyone else that was there. And, you know, they made the active decision. They said to just let us be in the pods. And so I think, you know, we had both thought too, we might be too boring to go to Mexico. So on proposal day, they told Danielle to like go back and change out of her proposal day dress and put on normal clothes. And the reason they did that was because they already had the story in mind that we were going to be the couple that gets together right away at the beginning. And they wanted to look like I proposed on a different day when they were all on the same day. And, you know, that kind of stuff, you just look back on, you're like, oh, they were like scripting this out. And maybe they thought we would be too boring if we had a producer that was just letting us be, you know? So it's possible that they needed someone to come in and drum up drama.
Yeah. The answer to all this is the solution that I came up with, which is more and more prevalent in other industries like the Screen Actors Guild, where there's an advocate. There's someone that an outside person who is on the side of the talent. This could be a couple of different roles, to a couple of different professionals, like you said, someone to help you understand the contract up front. I talked about this in a video I made the other day, that in my field of therapy, we have our forms that y'all sign. You've signed them, hopefully, with your therapist in the past. And if you just look those forms over, it's a lot of legalese-ish. It's supposed to be written in a way that a high schooler would be able to understand it, an average 10th grader be able to comprehend it. But it's just long and most people just glance over it. They don't really read every word. And even if they did, they don't necessarily understand it because they don't really know what they're getting into precisely. So for us, it's well understood ethically and morally that if we just have our clients sign it, that's not sufficient. because for us in our industry, we presumably we care about our clients, which is different from other industries. We actually aren't out to exploit. So we actually, as a practice, will verbally talk about some of the elements in the disclosure statement and say, just to make sure you understand before you get into this, you know, da 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 da. And so in our industry, we will understand that. In other industries, you know, the terms of service that you just click on your phone and say, I agree. A lot of these businesses are forced to do that, and they're incentivized to not really explain it to you. And in this industry as well, reality TV, they absolutely are incentivized to not really explain it to you, to get you to sign it really quickly. Oh, it's just a formality. Don't worry about it. And not have you really, in a very informed manner, consent to being on the show. So, and you realize now upon going through it and afterwards looking back, when you think about that moment when you signed the contract, I'm guessing you know now that you did not really understand what you were signing up for.
No, you know, people say you signed up for this. I have a whole reel about this, but you don't know what you're signing up for. And I, you know, I publicly spoke for work as part of my job. I do interviews, I speak at conferences. And, you know, because I read the contract, I was actually forbidden from doing that. There could be no public speaking. There could be no going on any type of interview or anything without their pre-approval from the time you're filming. And so like I had to have that amended just because of my job. But could you imagine, like, if I didn't read that and I signed that and then I went and did an interview or something, you know, not even related, but my likeness was then, you know, exposed to this, you know, marketing podcast or, you know, marketing conference. It's just crazy. Like you can't run for office. You can't be part of a union. Like there's so many little things in there. And unless you have someone explain it in the way you're saying you have to explain, you know, in the counseling field, then people don't know. And you don't know you're signing up for no water, no food, like,
yeah, no.
20-hour days.
I had recently been asked to sign a contract and I was about to sign it. Then I was like, oh, maybe I should run this past my lawyer. And I gave it to her and I thought she'd just glance it over. Yeah, looks good. No, she went line by line and said, well, this is a problem. And I was like, why? And she says, well, this could happen. And I thought, oh, I didn't even think of that.
It's not your area of expertise.
Yeah, I don't know because I haven't been down those roads before. And the person giving me the contract fully understands what those things could be, but I don't. And so to have an advocate there, and of course, the industry is not incentivized to do this, so they won't do it on their own. You have to have regulations, laws, or unions that force and laws to support the unions to force these people to do this. Now, in other industries, we have this. In acting, there are laws and regulations that have been developed, fought for by actors. The writers are going on strike, for example.
Well, I had a reel that I made on that yesterday, too. And the thing with the writer strike is every time in history the WGA has striked, which was the late 80s, which was the explosion of shows like Cops and Rescue 911, like the old school reality shows. And then it happened again in 2008. And that's when the explosion that we see today happens. And why does that happen? Because they can produce reality TV with reality casts that have no representation. They can produce it far cheaper and far more profitable. And they don't need the WGA.
Right. Because it's a new-ish industry or niche within the entertainment industry that has yet to organize, has yet to fight back. And I think there's a number of factors that play into it as to why that is. You know, there are a lot of regulations around kids working on the set that were not true 50 years ago. There are a lot of regulations about kids working in factories, for example, that were not true 100 years ago. I think there are a number of factors as to why it's taking so long for this to develop within the reality TV industry that you're obviously at the spearhead of. One is that I think people today, and this is just old man shakes fist at society, that people today forget the importance of labor rights and labor movements and unionization because it just feels like the norm. But a lot of people don't understand that the reason why you're not being exploited more on the job, it's not like exploitation doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. But the reason why, to, you know, in a general sense, it's not happening more is because of the people that came before you, the people who fought, the people who literally died on the picket line fighting against corporations and paid off police and thugs trying to break unionization, trying to break the resolve of politicians pushing for labor rights, accusing them of being communists, all this kind of stuff. It is, there's been so much blood, sweat, and tears and suffering that a lot of wonderful, altruistic, dedicated, moral people have done before us. And so there's this notion of just like, well, aren't corporations just generally good to labor? And the answer is no, they're not. Just look at history. Just look around the world. So that's one thing. Another is that there's this culture of hating cast members of reality TV, as you have now experienced.
I know. I don't get it. It's so crazy.
Yeah. When I first started making reaction videos on YouTube, and it was to the very first season of Love is Blind, I just reacted normally. And I'm a therapist, so I'm a particular kind of person, I suppose, but I don't think of myself as that different. And a lot of people were reacting very strongly, like, oh my God, you're just so different than what other people are saying. Like, no one talks like this. And you're so kind to these people. And I started to realize, and then I looked at what other people were saying about the cast members. And it was just not only negative, but like very negative. It was over the top negative. I mean, it was basically everyone hated everyone, regardless of anything. Like, everyone was a hated, horrific, you know, human being, according to the public. And I thought, what is going on? And because in other social situations, you don't see this. If you meet five people at a party, for example, you don't walk away from the party being like, I hated that person and their dress, you know, the body shaming and the just everything shaming, that the racism, the sexism, just completely unbridled things that you would never get away with talking about other kinds of, you know, individuals. And so I thought, what's going on? And it must have developed way before I was a part of this, you know, tens of years ago, with reality TV starting to become more popular, and maybe the internet or something. There just became this norm, this cultural norm that, yeah, we get to bully these people because they are now famous, and we all agree that that person is a target of our bullying, and we're going to get all of our anger and aggression and self-esteem problems out on that person. And no one can disagree with us. And if you push back on it, you're part of the problem, and you'll get bullied. And so when you and others speak out and say, hey, you know, the conditions on the job are horrible, and we need measures to be taken to protect people like us, me and people in the future, you know, the public doesn't hear it because they're used to bullying you.
I said this before, but I have like six friends, and I have done the work. I know my people. I shed those that aren't my people. I put boundaries around people who take too much, or I tend to give too much to. And so being thrust out of like my little bubble of, I know, you know, my people, and getting not just with like the cast and the whole world of reality TV, but the fact that I get exposed to, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not, well, it's millions of people, and seeing the stuff that they say, I still get the mean DMs, the comments, people. It has really alarmed me how damaged people are, to the point where they think that they can spew something behind a keyboard. That's clearly a projection of their own insecurities, as you mentioned, or I think there's a lot of projection of jealousy, like jealousy that, because we put fame on such a pedestal that people think fame's the end all be all. People think fame means you get the Brinks truck every day, dropping off money, and, you know, you just get to do whatever you want, and you know, you're better than everybody else. And that illusion of fame has caused people to like project jealousy, in my opinion, onto people who have gone through this. And I think in their mind, they're thinking, well, if I was famous, if I got to do this, I would have been able to handle it, or whatever it is. And they just don't know. And my favorite thing is people who say, that's not true, or you could have left, or even, you know, Nick Vile saying that, He needs to be proven that there wasn't food and water. He needs to see proof. Well, the proof's in the pudding. You got like seven people that just came out and said there was no freaking water. There's a lawsuit going on about it. So people just, they're just projecting all of these insecurities, all of this jealousy, all of this frustration with themselves onto people who literally they just spent 10, 12 hours getting entertained by.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The water thing is bizarre because that's the most easiest thing you could point to that was a problem, because obviously they could just give you, you know, gallons and gallons of water if they wanted to. They have the money.
I asked because I drink like two gallons a day.
They can give you or they can give you one of those office cooler thing. Yeah. Springs, yeah. 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 They could just it'd be so easy for them to do that. They probably have it for themselves in the production truck or something. The fact that you would have to ask for water and then what? They give you just like 1 ounce bottle or 12 ounce bottles or something. And you're like, okay, well, thanks, but I guess I'm going to have, you know, and that feeling you get, it's like, oh, I don't want to bother them. Or you call them and they're like, oh, okay, we'll send someone up. And then an hour later or something. And it just, why? There's no explanation for that. There's no, you know, the fact that they isolate you, arguably they could say that they don't want you to have drama or they don't want the story to progress without the cameras there. Okay, fine. But the water thing, what is the point in that? And you could even say, and this would be horrific, that they don't want you to eat because they don't want you to gain weight because they know you're going to be in a pool scene. That's horrific, right? That's awful. But at the same time, would have at least some semblance of how can we make this show more entertaining? You could see a justification there. A horrific, criminal, yes. But the water thing, there's no reason for that. There is no reason why you wouldn't give the cast members water unless you were trying to do something psychologically. I mean, it's really the only viable explanation, right?
I agree. And I will, you know, if they want to have the benefit of the doubt, I would say a producer's last thought is getting you water when they're trying to produce a show. I can say that is probably the best case scenario. But then the question becomes, well, why isn't there someone dedicated to making sure people have water?
Well, in all likelihood, they had pallets of water that were just sitting there and they're wasting money on paying someone to deliver individual water bottles. You each should have had your own pallet of, especially if it's 3 days and you can't leave. And why not? What is the point? It just doesn't make any sense. It's either really weird logistics and poor management, or there's something going on there. Or at the very least, did you or others say, hey, could you just give me more water so I don't have to ask? It's actually kind of bothering. Did you say anything during that time?
I did in the hotel. In the pods, I think we asked. I mean, everyone was asking, so we'd get like a 24 pack, but there's 15 guys and we just finished those in 3 minutes. You know, it's so crazy to me. And I did ask, I was like, can I get a case? Because I literally drink water, coffee and wine. Like that's my beverages. And I, like I said, I drink a ton of water. And so I asked him, like, I just get a full pack at one point. And I think I got three that time instead of two.
Yeah. That's just bizarre. That's gotta be something, because why wouldn't they give you just a pallet? They give you everything else, right? There's a overabundance of alcohol. I think it was a New York Times or it was Business Insider, where another cast member was saying that she indicated she liked a particular kind of tequila or something. And the next day there were 4 gallons of it just sitting there in the pod, something like that. It's off the top of my head. So of course they want you to be comfortable. They want you to be on the show. They want you to be ready to go with your drama and your activity and falling in love. So they have every reason in the world to try to make your life as comfortable as possible. What is the deal with water?
I know. You know, what's interesting too is when we filmed After the Altar, which was a little over a year ago, we were on location in Michigan at a beautiful house, and it was a total different experience. And I think it's because we all had platforms, so we would have exposed that a lot easier, right? And so I think it's pretty sad that when before people have a platform, they just don't get water. They don't have access to the food that they want to eat or that they need to eat when they need to eat it.
So I've been yammering a lot in my videos, especially this past season of Love is Blind, about the bullying, the mob bullies, the bully mobs. I think because it's become more seen by me, I've just noticed it more. And also because I went through it last year when I was reacting, I posted a bunch of reaction videos to the Johnny Depp Amber Heard trial, and I went through a pretty dark time in my life. And I've documented it a lot on this channel, but I'm just going to take a guess. It pales in comparison to what you've been through. So I want people to really understand what it's like, the emotional toll. The thing that the evolutionary basis for this that I will highlight, and of course, there's no way to know this precisely, but it makes sense to me, is that we evolved to seek approval and to run away or to try to limit rejection. When we evolved on the Pleistocene African savanna, you know, being accepted by our tribe was survival, and to be rejected was very quick death by starvation or literally a leopard eating us, because we were predated upon by predators. So we evolved. Those people who didn't necessarily care about being, you know, about being approved of would soon die. And those who were obsessed with being accepted and approved of survived. So we carry that with us naturally, and it explains a lot of our behavior. And when we have some notoriety, and we, for instance, even if 90% of what people are saying about us is positive, 5-10% is negative, that negative attention is so much more relevant to our evolution and so much more noticed and ruminated upon, that biologically we just can't handle it. We can't say to ourselves, I need to have a tough skin, or but look at all these other people who like me, or they don't really know me. We're animals. We don't understand. We can't really get on top. We understand it intellectually, but the rest of our body doesn't understand it, and it takes a toll. So what were the effects on you specifically?
So when this, I remember when this first came out, I wasn't really concerned. I'm pretty confident. I was pretty confident in who I was. I have a strong like value system, and you know, my motto is just do the right thing. And for me, I just kept thinking to myself, okay, I'll be fine. I don't really care what internet people think about me. And then I saw what it was doing to Danielle. And
she probably got it worse, right? Women often get it a lot worse.
She got it. I mean, there were days where like she couldn't get off the couch. Like I couldn't get her off the couch. I couldn't get her to move, you know, move outside. Like she was just in so much pain. I don't even like to think about it, because it's so hard. But you know, as time went on, and then the hate slows, right? Because then the people that are following you and paying attention to you are there for you, or there for, you know, whatever, just passively. But it definitely slowed down. But then when we separated, and that all happened very quickly, and it leaked on TMZ before I even told my family. And that was when I started to feel it, like myself. I started feeling the people accusing me of cheating, calling me a narcissist, and among many other horrific insults, being abusive. The cheating one was really hurt, because that one was literally because my friend was visiting and we were at brunch in a group, and someone saw us at the brunch place, started a Reddit thread, and it just took off. And so like, I didn't cheat. I'm not emotionally abusive. I'm not a narcissist, you know, and I've been in therapy for 6 years, and I like know who I am, and I'm comfortable with who I am, but it gets to you. And then, you know, Danielle didn't always speak what I would say would be the truth about me, which would stem more and more hate every single time something like that would happen. And that was the part where I was kind of at rock bottom, because, you know, and I still feel it, because, and it's not what people were saying, it's that it was coming from something that she had said, and that hurt more that it was from her than these trolls. But even now it's hard to feel confident in myself, because there has been so much hate. And then taking on the You Can Foundation and trying to literally help people who need help, And people are looking at this as some sort of like attempt to get rich and famous. And it's like, yeah, because people who start not-for-profits that are designed literally to help people and they do it pro bono while they don't have a job and while they don't have a steady income, like that's how you get rich and famous. It's just crazy.
Yeah. So for me, when I was going through it, I would lose sleep. I would find you say that there was.
Can I ask? So you were commenting on Amber Heard and Johnny Depp, and people were coming after you for your commentary.
Yeah.
What kind of stuff would they say?
People made complaints about me to my licensing board, I think, based on my commentary that were so absurd. The licensing board didn't even follow it up.
Good.
That's terrifying to think that people would
try
to harm me. Yeah. And that they would make it so that my current clients and future clients could never talk to me again. Not only that, but death threats, obviously. People saying it's terrifying when you have, if one person says something negative about me, that hurts my feelings. But if you have hundreds of people that are in a Reddit thread and they're all upvoting and they're all talking about you and they have an extreme negative lens that they're looking at you through, and they're making stuff up essentially. And then, one person will make something up and then everyone just takes it as gospel.
Yeah, where's the critical thinking?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's terrifying because even if they never say, let's go get him or let's kill him or let's poison his dogs or let's dox him or let's go after his parents, like they don't have to say that necessarily. Some of them did, but even it's terrifying when a group of, if you have, just imagine that you have three people that you know in your life that are very close friends with each other and they hate you times a thousand. They just hate you. So you get worried. You think, well, what could they do? And they seem to be thinking about you all day long. So you just start worrying. It's natural to worry. And so that terror and what it affected for me is my confidence is I started to second guess everything I was saying. My livelihood is this podcast and the YouTube channel. And I started, I noticed myself being really tentative and having a hard time getting sentences out because I was scared of incurring the wrath of these internet mobs. And my hands are sweating even just thinking about it. You know, I have kind of a traumatic,
too. I'm not even kidding you.
traumatic reaction to it. You know, it's terrifying. So how did it affect your confidence?
Like I said, I felt like I was at rock bottom. I got, there were some very negative things in the press. I got laid off from my job a couple of days later. I've heard both sides. But what it did is it set me into this set where I agreed to talk to Dr. Isabel Morley, who is on our board at the UCAN Foundation as the director of mental health services. And she reached out to me and wanted to talk for an article she was writing about Love is Blind in Psychology Today. And I am avoidant attachment style and everything. I was avoiding a lot of these feelings that I had inside. Everything happened so fast with the separation and the divorce. And I had asked for time to figure out, like, find myself again, because I totally lost myself to the point where I couldn't even get a sentence out. And then after all of this, I just kind of, I was in shock. And when I talked to Isabel, it was like a 3-hour Zoom call. And after that, I just talked from beginning to end of this whole thing. And I was wrecked. I didn't want to go anywhere. I didn't want to be outside. I didn't want to go to the grocery store. I didn't want to, you know, have anyone stop me and ask for a photo or say hi. That continued for weeks over the holidays. They were just horrible. I wouldn't say that I'm confident again, but I'm confident in what I'm doing with the UCAN Foundation, and I'm confident in taking on big reality TV and doing that for basic human rights. And my confidence in a relationship, my confidence to show up online is a work in progress. Mm-hmm. Again, this has helped because, you know, I'm stubborn. So when I believe in something and I think it's, you know, doing the right thing, I will dig my feet in and every hit that comes will make me stronger. And, that's the activist side of me that I've been doing since 2008. And I will thrive in that. But my confidence to show up online and share my experience or show up here and share my experience, you can, you maybe don't know, but like my voice has been trembling the whole time because it's a lot. And I don't want to, you know, I don't want to upset anybody or disparage anyone or separate anyone because I think we're all in this together. But it is, it's hard to show up. Like the thought of like dating to me, it's like not even on my radar, like no confidence to do that. Like, what do I have to offer? You know, and it's brutal and it's based on, you know, all of this. And yeah. The other thing too, that I think you probably, I don't think I got any death threats, but I also had a friend that was managing my social for a few months because the comments, because I was working, I couldn't keep up with it. I didn't really want to keep up with it. And it's hard to read them, as you know, even if you delete them. And they give you that training before the show comes out. They put you on a Zoom call and say, okay, here's your public eye training, basically. And it's when someone says something mean about you, delete it and block them. Like, okay, great. Thank you. So yeah, my confidence is, I'm trying to build it back up, but it's there in some ways and not anywhere in other ways.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you're talking about it so that people can understand the toll that it will take. It's such a dehumanizing experience, not only for yourself, but the internet mobs, the way people talk. Someone else experienced this. I can't remember who it was. They were talking about how they were incurring this internet mob, and they actually looked into all the people that were on this one Reddit thread and actually figured out who all the people were based on triangulating. And there were therapists in this mob. There were teachers, elementary, you know, people that you would think are not supposed to do that, would not do that. You know, you think these internet mobs are made up of just a bunch of deplorables, and they're not. They're everybody. They're potentially, you might be in one of these internet mobs if you don't watch out. So anyway,
I know. I'm very careful of paying attention to that. I'm like, is this going to get me blocked?
Yeah. So I'm glad that you're talking about it so people can understand just how horrible it is, just how it gets under your skin and potentially lasts the rest of your life. The way you're talking is exactly the way that people will talk upon leaving an abusive relationship or a cult, I suppose, but more commonly an abusive relationship or having been sexually assaulted, for example. And the depression, the isolation, the low self-esteem. We like to think of ourselves, particularly Americans, as independent psychological creatures. We are not. We think of ourselves the way that people think of us. We think of ourselves, we treat ourselves the way other people treat us. We understand this. So if you out there are like yourself and you have good people in your life that are treating you well, it's because you have a history of that in all likelihood. You have a history of people treating you well, thus you believe in yourself. If you have low self-esteem and you have people in your life that don't treat you well, it's probably because that's where you came from, that we tend to just believe that to be the way the world works. And so when the world is treating you like crap, then you just start to think of yourself as crap. And even though intellectually you're thinking that doesn't make any sense, I know that I have worth, the body doesn't necessarily know that. If I can humanize you and by extension, yeah, everyone else that's going through it, Danielle included, then, you know, I want to do that. And also the element of, for a lot of people, upon getting out of an abusive, high control relationship, a road to wellness, a road to power, a road to confidence is to fight that which abused you, whether it's the individual by going to the police or the whole industry or the whole practice of abusive relationships. So you have a very common emergence out of that pain and isolation to say, you know what, I'm not going to turn this anger inward anymore, you know, and it, I don't know, it makes me tear up thinking about, but I'm going to point this anger at least some of the time towards those who deserve it. And I'm not going to spew a bunch of aggression. I'm going to actually try to change. And the thing that I saw in an interview that you did, I can't remember the fella's name, but your colleague at the UCAN Foundation.
Yeah, you can.
Jeremy was talking about how there's enough drama on this show and other shows. You don't have to manufacture it and you don't have to cultivize everybody. That there's enough drama there. And I've been saying that myself as well. When this last season, which you didn't watch, they seemingly, according to the two people involved, edited it in the way to make Jackie looked like she had cheated when she hadn't.
I was messaging with Jackie about that.
I reviewed all that footage and said, even before Marshall came out and confirmed that it was edited in a way to make it look like she cheated, I reviewed all that footage and said, you know, it's heavily edited, so it's possible. I mean, it's strangely heavily edited during those scenes. So they didn't have to do that. There was enough drama there between Jackie and Marshall that they didn't have to manufacture it. It's like this compulsion that they have. They can't even help themselves even when they don't have to. It's like they want to justify their jobs, or they want to justify their salaries or something. Or
their storyline that they want you to be in instead of the one you're actually in.
Right. And meanwhile, the cast members are thrown under the bus and they've already signed a quote unquote contract. And I say quote unquote because, you know, it doesn't really follow the spirit of what a contract is. They get away with it. There's no consequence, and they roll in money because of it. So I applaud your efforts. And I have to admit, when I first heard of the reports that came out, I don't know, a year or two ago, maybe it was Jeremy, I'm not sure. I read it in an article or something, and I just thought, well, that doesn't fit with my worldview. It doesn't, especially with Love is Blind, because it seems more humane. It just seems more.
That's the only reason I went on it, was because they convinced me and my therapist, talked to the psychologist that did my psych exam, and they convinced me and her that this is legit. Like, we're not looking for influencers or bachelor people. We are vetting people to make sure that they are ready for love and there for marriage. And I mean, in retrospect, I feel stupid. And again, like, that's not like Danielle was there for the right reasons. We were both there for the right reasons, but that's not everyone.
Yeah, clearly a lot of people are. There's 6 or 7 couples that are currently married because of it, right? So clearly a lot of people are there for the right reasons. So you don't have to manufacture things. There's enough. And, you know, my wife watched Love is Blind Japan, and there's almost none of the drama. And yet it's a very entertaining show. It's just a different culture, I'm guessing, of regarding how you make a show in Japan as to how you make a show in the United States. And also comment that I imagine that behind the scenes, there are a lot of choices, a lot of whys in the road that production comes to where they could go in a more manipulative direction and they don't. There's a fair amount of evidence of that, at least from my perspective. But anyway, but clearly there are whys in the road where they make the manipulative, exploitative choice. But the first time I have to admit, when I heard the early reports, I thought, well, that doesn't really fit with me. And so it took me a while, and it took actually what you and Danielle were talking about. And again, at first I just thought, well, I'm not really feeling it. But then as I started looking into it more, reading the articles, watching your interviews and some of your reels, I thought, well, wait, you know, it takes a while for the paradigm shift to happen. Mm-hmm. And I'm in a position where I have the time, and I presumably you could say even get paid to kind of look into all this sort of stuff. But I worry about the general public and their worldview, because we want to enjoy these shows. We want to like them. We don't want to feel bad for watching them. We don't want to feel like we're part of the problem, which I think is another reason why people will initially reject it, right?
Yeah, I think people, I agree with you. I think people look at it, and if they have to, again, it's almost like a reflection maybe, where if they look at it and they see how horrible these people are for their entertainment, they feel like a bad person. And that's not the case. I don't begrudge anybody for watching these shows. Reality TV shows are just fine to have. They're fine to produce. We just got to do it with more humane conditions.
Yeah.
My thought to everyone out there, you don't have to feel bad for watching reality TV. What you should focus on is changing the way that these shows are produced so that it protects human beings. Mm-hmm. Because if we can get that change, we can all enjoy reality TV and the entire experience. Mm.
Yeah. Yeah. That feels good to me personally, because I enjoy watching these shows. And so I hear this often about, you know, there should be therapists there. And then Netflix will say, well, we do have therapists on call, and we have 2 psychologists who are screening and that kind of thing. And from reports, it looks like it's really cursory, or they just catch the more obvious problematic or at-risk individuals. But the way that I would imagine that people might be pushing for, it's just like you have therapists, maybe more therapists that are on call. But you know, as well as I do, that to have a good relationship with a therapist, it takes a long time. And so what you would really want is their therapist. You know, like your therapist should have been there, should have been paid to be there with you physically or something.
Well, I will say they do say that if you need to talk to your therapist, they will arrange that for you when you're in the pods and in Mexico. I was seeing her twice a week when we got back, trying to navigate all of the you know, pressure cookers. But what I would say to that is, if they had anyone on set, they should have shown themselves in Mexico. As soon as someone has an anxiety or a panic attack, or saying that they're having suicidal ideation thoughts, that would be the moment that you, if you don't have one, you get one. And if you do have one, they come out. And, you know, I think about it like the NFL too. You know, 10 years ago in the NFL, a coach on the sideline could send someone back in who maybe had a concussion and make that decision. Mm-hmm. And maybe it was longer than 10 years ago, but then there was a medical staff, but that's the team medical staff, right? And if it's the playoffs and the game's on the line and it's your starting quarterback or your number one running back, you know, maybe we'll risk that they have a concussion and send them back out there. Now there's an independent doctor, neurologist on the sidelines for each team for every single game, and they have to clear someone before they can go in the concussion protocol, mm-hmm. because they're independent. And that's where I think we need to get to in reality TV, is that there are independent mental health professionals that are there to help people in need, to help people navigate these complex scenarios, to help people develop healthy conflict resolution, and so on. And I don't think it's that much to ask.
Yeah. Yeah. And I love that, that analogy with NFL, because that was what I was saying while I was reading the various articles about this effort to try to have more mental health care, that I was saying, well, they kind of already do. They could argue they already have that. But unless you have an independent individual, also not only an independent psychologist, mental health individual, but they need to have power, and not just power that the show gives them, but regulatory legal power.
Exactly.
To actually do something about it, that because without that, it's toothless. The therapist is being paid by the production and will be fired if they don't play ball. And whether or not that's explicitly told to the therapist or not, doesn't necessarily matter. Yeah, they understand that if I don't play ball, I'm going to get fired. So I'm going to follow the, you know, what, who's giving me my paycheck? Well, it's the show. It's not the clients. So you'd have to have that. And of course, that could also just be the role of an advocate. It wouldn't have to necessarily be a mental health individual. It could just be, I don't know much about it, but in the acting world, I believe that when you have a sex scene now, you have an advocate that's there to make sure that you're not being sexually or physically exploited, because that would happen in the past, particularly to women. I don't know all the ins and outs about that, but it could look like that. And again, yeah, would it be kind of a pain in the ass for these production teams to deal with? Sure. As I'm sure it's a pain in the ass to some extent that these individuals are on the set during a sex scene, but it enhances the whole thing. It protects people. Presumably people want that. Also, it makes your product more palatable to the public. Mm-hmm. When you have sweatshops, for example, no one wants to buy your product because they feel like they're part of the problem. And if you have reality TV and you have practices in place that actually protect everyone, or at least reduce the risks and the harm, then the public presumably will be more likely to consume your product, as opposed to consuming a different reality TV show that doesn't do that. You know, you can sort of differentiate yourself in that way.
Well, imagine what that would do to destigmatize couples counseling. Like if we had someone that hopped in during a conflict and helped us navigate that and helped us communicate better with each other and helped us learn how to listen a little bit better, that would help so many people. And also that's entertaining, because you're still getting the conflict, but you're seeing people grow from it, hopefully. And maybe it'll cause you and your spouse at home to be like, hey, if they can do it, you know, maybe we can do it.
Yeah, absolutely. Sometimes I wonder, though, if that would actually be compelling to the audience. It would be to you and I, but it wouldn't necessarily be to others. But I don't know. I've heard rumors that there's a 90 Day Fiancé couples therapy season that's coming out. I don't have a lot of confidence in that. Typically, on these shows when there is a couple therapy session. It's just one and it's not great to begin with. Or on Married at First Sight, they have these individuals that are there to quote unquote help. And I've commented on the sessions that they have with the couples and I've said that they don't look great. Yeah. In a perfect world, you could have therapists on Love is Blind who are actually there and you could opt in to have it filmed or not filmed, you know, for example, you know,
right.
And maybe if it's
That's
not filmed,
too.
It's summarized afterwards, you know, for people to just get a sense of what happened. You wouldn't have to have everything filmed all the time. But the last question I have for you, and, you know, I'll cut all this out if you don't want to talk about it, but I'm personally curious, you mentioned you watched my reaction videos. You also mentioned that you have avoidant attachment. When I was watching your relationship, and I said earlier, it was very commonplace, not mundane or insignificant, but I have worked with a lot of couples where one person is preoccupied, another person is avoidant. And the dynamic between you and Danielle, I didn't notice it at first, but especially as you were seeing each other in person, you started having your initial arguments. I started to hypothesize. I could never know, but I would always say, well, I would have to talk to them. And now I'm talking to you. And so I'm always wondering, you know, one, did I ever hurt your feelings? Two, how accurate was it? And I'm sure there's a lot more nuance to it than I could possibly know because it's just an edited TV show. But yeah, did I ever hurt your feelings? And did you know if I ever hurt Danielle's feelings?
So I didn't watch any of this until after we separated because I didn't really, and I didn't know. I didn't know there was such a big, like, commentary community in this. I'm so naive. I wasn't on social media very often. I didn't really engage, you know, outside of my life, and I didn't really watch a lot of reality TV. So it was all very, like, shocking to me. So when I went back, I started seeing, you know, these videos pop up in my YouTube feed and stuff. And I would watch a couple, some therapists, and I, you know, poor takes, I felt sometimes in poor taste, other, you know, just regular people commentating, which is totally fine. Just brutal takes though. And then I remember there were two or three of yours I watched about us and you never hurt my feelings. I kind of remember like thinking, so again, it was a while ago. I kind of remember thinking like, oh my God, you actually seem to care. Mm. Like you're not here saying, oh, they shouldn't be getting married or, oh, they shouldn't this. It was like wanting to help us in that given situation. Mm. And I thought that was such a different take on, you know, how to approach it. And, you know, I was trying to understand what the hell happened. And so you helped me a little bit in seeing those, in those moments where when you're in them, you just don't see it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the way it looked to me, and again, I'll cut all this out if you don't want to get into it. I'm sure you don't want to throw Danielle under the bus. I'm sure you have very complicated feelings as anyone would after a divorce. The way it looked to me was that Danielle even talked about how she had some difficulties growing up and she had a belief, a schema that she was going to be abandoned, that people weren't going to love her. We all have that worry, but she seemingly had that a lot more than other people do. And I've treated a lot of people like that's a very common thing, preoccupied mm-hmm. attachment. And when there was a question mark, which there often are, particularly in the beginning of a relationship, particularly as you're being denied water and other kinds of things, and you're stressed out, you're being filled, that for her, it was really challenging and would cause her to go to a dark place where she thought she was going to be abandoned by you, that you were going to leave her like so many people before you had. And then not only just, okay, that's a bummer, but also a descent into the downward spiral of shame and self-hatred and suicidality. She talked about that in another article about how she was suicidal at times while she was on the show. And I, you know, that seemed like that was what was happening. And then for you in the beginning, you were being very caring. You were listening. You were not reacting. You were there for her. And I thought, oh, actually, maybe this will work because often if you're preoccupied and you have someone who cares, who doesn't overreact, who doesn't distance, who doesn't feel insulted and attacked, that stability can happen over time. But then over time, it seemed like it started to wear on you and you started to get upset, which makes sense. But then the way you dealt with the insult or the, because in a sense, you're being rejected. You're being told that you're thinking a certain thing. And
yeah, being told you're thinking something or that you said something you didn't say is very, it's a very hard thing to navigate.
Right. And that's a very common thing in this dynamic. And over time, it just hurts and it feels like the same old thing happening over and over again. And you don't have a couple therapists to help you navigate that. It, again, if I or another competent therapist were around, it would at least be attempted to try to help frame what was happening for the two. Anyway, then over time for you, it started to take its toll and you started to go to a dark place for yourself. Avoiding attachment also comes from problematic, you know, difficulties when we're young, and we just deal with it differently. The worry of rejection, the worry of accusation, for example, is dealt with by avoidance and anger and rejection and get away from me. And then there seemed to be some moments where it was taking such a toll on you that you were reacting to things against her that didn't really even justify it. You know, there were times when you were pushing back and it made sense, but then there were times when she would just say something and it would just kind of trigger something in you that it felt like something was happening from Danielle and a resentment was building up in you and it sort of all would come out. I'm spewing out a lot of stuff at you, but and you can say I can neither confirm nor deny any of this, but and I guess I'm saying this because I would hope that if any of this is even possibly true, and of course you have your own therapist, but that the next time you have a relationship, maybe there's some knowledge there, some alerts, because you'll probably end up having those impulses in the future again, because that's how attachment style goes. But I guess I'm just curious as to what your thoughts were on that.
Okay, so it's just me right now. This is after the interview, and I'm going to chime in here because after I allowed Nick to respond to my very lengthy question and summary of what I saw in his relationship with Danielle, we talked for a long time, and he consented to me actually including the question that I asked, but he didn't want his response to be out there. We had a very long conversation. It was very in-depth about his experiences. And what I'll say is that he can neither confirm nor deny what I was proposing as my hypothesis about their relationship. So let's get back to the interview.
So one last question, Nick. What could people do to make a change in the reality TV industry as you've been calling for?
There's a couple ways. One, you can come support the UCAN Foundation at ucanfoundation.org. Follow us on social media. Follow me on social media. The foundation is the_UCAN_foundation. I'm nthompson513, a lot easier to find. Share the content, learn. I'm sharing what these experiences were really like. I'm also a mental health advocate, so I throw in some self-care tips every now and then, or journaling, or things that help me out. But if we're going to change the scope of how reality TV is produced, and we're going to treat people like human beings, I understand that it starts with all of us. It's the bottom. That's how you organize. It always comes from the bottom up. And so sharing, support, driving awareness, donating if you can. And more than anything else, just share. Mm-hmm. Share these stories. I have countless DMs that I'm working through from other reality cast members that have reached out to share their story. They're all terrified to go publicly, but I have some that I'm going to be able to share very, very soon, so you can get a real understanding of what people go through. So thank you for the opportunity. Thank you for supporting, and just let's drive awareness so we can get some change.
Yeah, I commend you. I could see in the history books 50 years from now that Nick Thompson will be identified as an initial pioneer in the movement to humanize reality TV and to raise awareness and to start the ball rolling regarding regulations that are present in almost every other industry in the United States regarding labor. So I think that that is great.
All right. Well, that's my interview with Nick Thompson. If you're curious about the organization he was talking about, it's UCAN, so the letter U, C-A-N, and it stands for Unscripted Cast Advocacy Network. And I think this is an important movement, and so I hope that you all support it. You can support UCAN, you can also raise awareness, and you start watching shows that have more ethical treatment of the cast members, then we can all push the industry in that direction, right? So let's all try to do our part. And everyone out there, please take care of yourself, because you deserve it. You really, really do.